Hi, I'm Derek Acora, and I've been invited to introduce the bad cast. Hang on a second. Gwen, are you sure this has nothing to do with the bad psychics or John Donnis? I'm sure Colin Fry told me something about finding himself introducing the Bad Psychics podcast. If I ever find out I'm on a podcast run by that idiot, I swear I will knock his block off.
This is Catherine Coe reporting for the Badcast. I'll be introducing you to another facet of the rich world of woo, specifically reconnective healing. I stumbled across this type of healing through an advert which presented the opportunity to find out what's baffling the medical community, discover why hospitals and universities around the world are investing time and money to understand these unprecedented healings. And the ad further made the remarkable claim that reconnective healing had been presented at the United Nations, no less, and prominently featured in the New York Times. Initial investigation revealed that reconnective healing was discovered, or should I say created, by American chiropractor Eric Pearl some years ago, apparently while I was living under a rock, because Eric is an international bestseller and has authored a suite of 6 books on the subject of healing. He's also headlined alongside John Edward and Sylvia Brown. On his website, www.thereconnection.com, Eric describes this discovery when, after 12 years of chiropractic practice, one day patients began reporting they felt his hands on them, even though he hadn't physically touched them. Sounds a bit dodgy. Or anyway, for the first couple of months, his palms blistered and bled. Poor lamb. But patients soon reported seeing angels and receiving miraculous healing. And judging by the Google hits, reconnective healing practitioners are so common, I could randomly fire my crossbow out of the nearest window and have a good chance of hitting one in the posterior. So after a bit of digging, the New York Times feature turned out to be an aptly titled article, "Prophet or Profiteer, This Doctor Is Now In." The exact context of the presentation to the United Nations remains elusive, however, despite being much touted on associated sites. I did flick an email to the United Nations to ask if they had kept a note of it in their diary, but alas, no reply. I guess they've got their hands a bit full at the moment. Anyway, down to the nuts and bolts. What is it and how does it work? Eric's site tells me, somewhat vaguely, that it reconnects us to the fullness of the universe as it reconnects us to the fullness of our beings and of who we are. This reconnection is achieved not just through a new set of healing frequencies, but through possibly an entirely new bandwidth. Note the possibly. And how is it different from your garden variety healing? The weaknesses the old techniques are subject to, such as requiring the removal of jewellery, the removal of leather, and faith on the part of the recipient, are not present in the new frequencies. Which is handy because when you're wearing leather, it can be a bit tricky to remove. With sessions costing anywhere between £35 and £55, this type of healing is done without physical touching. Oh, that's no fun. And can be conducted remotely, presumably via the special frequencies and bandwidth. So you don't even have to move a muscle. Now, in terms of scale, we're talking about 65,000 practitioners being trained via these seminars worldwide. And in terms of results, clients have reported receiving miraculous healing from cancers, AIDS-related diseases, chronic fatigue syndrome, birth disfigurement, cerebral palsy, and other serious afflictions. However, a closer inspection with my magnifying glass revealed the site did include the appropriate disclaimers to cover the aforementioned posteriors. Interestingly, the site makes the claim that the reality of its existence has demonstrated itself clearly in practice as well as in science laboratories. Really? Well, tell me more. A thorough search of Eric's official site revealed no details of the findings of these studies, although some websites of independent practitioners published results including, in lab studies, reconnective healing practitioners have been shown to affect changes in DNA, helping plants to heal after being shocked or damaged, which inspired me to muse upon how you go about shocking a plant. Sneak up on it in stealth mode, I guess. Back to the findings. Reconnective healing triggers significant changes in brain activity via EEG scans and heart activity via ECG scans of both practitioner and patient during these sessions. In a third sample result, other measurement studies confirm that reconnective healing practitioners emit and transmit an increased amount of light and other electromagnetic frequencies around their bodies. All of which is mildly interesting and sounds somewhat official, but doesn't prove to me at least that reconnective healing has a curing or healing effect on human subjects, i.e. even if the tests have demonstrated some effect to physiology, such as increased heart rate, that would be a significant leap. In other attempts to scientifically back up this practice, some independent practitioners' sites claim that this form of healing is akin to quantum healing, which is associated with quantum physics, though I know not how. Now, I'm not a doctor or physicist, but thankfully the New York Times did consult Dr. James H. Thomas of the Genetics Department at the University of Washington, who does not think much of Dr. Pearl's claim to be reconnecting us to other realities and virtual strands of DNA that are evolving. Dr. Thomas is quoted as saying, "I looked at Dr. Pearl's website. He is either a charlatan or delusional." Yeah, what he said. Personally, I remain very skeptical of Eric and his healing vibes. I find it frustrating he makes claims about his healing techniques standing up to scientific scrutiny, yet does not publish the specifics of these findings on his own site. At least one of the scientists he is affiliated with, William Tiller, appeared in the film What the Bleep Do We Know, which posits a spiritual connection between quantum physics and consciousness, and has been criticized as misrepresenting science, containing pseudoscience, and has been described as quantum mysticism. Be dubious, people. Be very dubious. So there you have the elevator speech on reconnective healing. Well, if we were ascending a particularly tall building anyway. Incidentally, the facilitator of this particular upcoming seminar is Doug DeVito. Not sure if he's related to Danny, but I do know he has a background in marketing for a range of Fortune 100 companies, which surely makes him a real asset. Meow. This has been Catherine Coe, reporting for the Badcast.
Hello, I'm David Kemp. I've just finished my new book, Dark Fiction, and would like to tell you a little bit about it. An aspiring young writer attending a prestigious university is thrilled when the school's most famous professor, a best-selling author, decides to become his mentor. Although ecstatic to find that some dreams really do come true, the young writer is horrified to learn that so do some nightmares. When his mentor's dark secret is finally revealed, he realizes there are things worse than even those conjured up by a horror writer's imagination. I promise you that this book is likely to be very different from anything else you have ever read. It is a cautionary tale to aspiring writers everywhere. Never sell your soul to write a bestseller. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com and read a review at www.mastersofhorror.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Noel Boyven from thesharkguys.com, and I'm here for the Badcast to discuss pareidolia, specifically the never-ending delusional version of Where's Waldo for the Devout that sees centuries-dead holy figures being spotted in places ranging from some guy's lunch to rock formations on Mars. Wikipedia defines pareidolia as a psychological phenomenon involving a vague and random stimulus, often an image or sound, being perceived as significant. Carl Sagan theorized that our brains are hardwired from birth to recognize the human face in particular. It's a trait that comes in handy for a baby looking to target his screams for food and or a diaper change, but one that's less useful when, say, relaxing at a park and looking up at the sky, only to find a cloud has morphed into the face of Chucky, the bloodthirsty doll from the Child's Play films. Of course, only someone who has devoted some serious time to watching campy late 80s, early 90s horror films would see Chucky, and likewise, only a person who is religiously devout would see Christ in a water stain on a wall and feel the need to call a priest instead of a plumber. We may be hardwired to identify patterns and see faces where there are none, but exactly which faces we see depends entirely on our own experiences and expectations. On thesharkguys.com, our interest in pareidolia was first piqued by a Daily Mail story about a taxi driver who recognized the face of Christ in the foil on the neck of a bottle of cider he was drinking. It was not mentioned how many bottles were already on his tab at that point, but hopefully he made this discovery after turning in the taxi's keys for the evening. He took a photo of Christ in the foil, and the face recognizable in it was a far more frightening, bug-eyed-looking creature than any of the commonly accepted Western representations of Christ. To see the Cider Savior, along with other images mentioned during this podcast, check out the Badcast official website at badcast.co.uk. We have gone on to cover other incidents of believers and those having a laugh and or making a buck at their expense, spotting Christ in some less than hallowed places. Sightings in food are quite common, for example, particularly the kind of food that will put a true believer on the express track to the great beyond. The significance of this is a matter best left to the theologians, but for some reason it is very rare for the Virgin Mary or Jesus to turn up in healthy food, say the face of the Virgin on a carrot stick or a recreation of the Last Supper spotted in a garden salad. It's far more common for these holy icons to appear to the faithful in artery-hardening fare, such as, most recently, on a bucket of pizza sauce and a pan of burnt bacon. Well, in those two cases, an equally convincing argument could have been made for the sauce bucket bearing the image of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and the pan the specter of Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher Cutting in Gangs of New York. We've covered Jesus turning up on a pancake, a pierogi, a Kit Kat bar, and of course, who can forget the grilled cheese sandwich with the likeness of the Virgin Mary, or perhaps Ingrid Bergman, that sold for $28,000 on eBay in 2004. And it may be hard to imagine a time when people merely ate their meals instead of studying them in the hopes of having a divine encounter. But it wasn't really until 1977 that the latter trend really took off. It was then that a New Mexico housewife discovered the face of Jesus in the skillet burns of a tortilla she was preparing. This unusual relic became the centerpiece of the Shrine of the Holy Tortilla, which the woman had built in her home. In under 2 years, the shrine drew some 35,000 people, and it would continue to attract the faithful intermittently over the years, long after the perceived holy image had disappeared, until the tortilla was finally destroyed after being dropped during a classroom show-and-tell session, in what is surely a first in the world of religious artifacts. A pickup truck also became an unlikely site of religious devotion in 2005, when a man in Laredo, Texas, found the image of Christ, or Kurt Cobain, or maybe Jimi Hendrix, depending on your age and your musical sensibilities, in the dirt on the tailgate of his pickup truck. Visitors to the holy parking spot lit candles, took photos, and prayed. The proud owner said it was a call for Christians to renew their faith. A more cynical observer might have added a speech bubble to the holy image containing the words, "Wash me," to communicate a more pressing earthly message. Well, I have mostly talked about pareidolia as it applies to icons of Christianity. This trend is by no means specific to just that faith, as demonstrated when locals in Kazakhstan, for example, claimed a chicken had laid an egg with the word Allah inscribed on it in Arabic, and were convinced that the egg wouldn't go bad. There are no follow-up reports on how that worked out for them. The variations of the Jesus seen on tortilla story and other examples of religious pareidolia are too numerous to mention here, and there is no foreseeable end to them. On our site alone, we've covered a cross-section of Jesus sightings that includes Christ appearing on a coffee table, an I Love Vegas toilet seat, a couch stain, the surface of Mars, a nebula in space, and in what was a disturbingly strong likeness on the backside of a dog. These sightings are limited only by the ability of devotees to reinterpret what they see through the lens of religious devotion, and in that respect, they are limitless. For the Badcast, I'm Noel Boyven.
Birmingham Skeptics in the Pub is every second Wednesday of the month at the Victoria on John Bright Street, right behind the Alexandra Theatre. Join us for fantastic speakers and good sceptical company. Coming up, we've got Dr. David Gregory, science correspondent for the BBC, the irrepressible Professor David Cahoon, the renowned Professor Chris French, and the excellent Andy Lewis, inventor of the Quackometer. You've seen them on the telly, read their blogs and tweets, now come and meet them in the flesh. To find full details and how to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, simply Google Birmingham Skeptics and Pub. Remember, it's the second Wednesday at the Victoria. All talks are free, but we do ask for a small donation to cover expenses as we are still awaiting sponsorship from Big Pharma. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Aaron for the Badcast, and you know what's bad. What's bad has been arrested for peaceful protest in a supposed democracy like the United Kingdom. Let me tell you a bit about my story. Basically, I was doing a protest against a company called Kudos Pharmaceuticals. It was a small protest, and we were protesting against the fact that Kudos Pharmaceuticals is owned by AstraZeneca, who have links to Huntingdon Life Sciences, which is the most exposed animal testing lab in the world. They test things like GMOs, household chemicals, etc. on animals. They have been exposed time and time again for animal cruelty. They were filmed punching puppies in the face at one point, for example. There's been a lot of direct action associated with the campaign, civil disobedience, etc. And you probably heard about it in the media because of that. Whatever your views on direct action, civil disobedience, and animal rights in general, this story is not about that. It's about the way the police use the law to effectively limit free speech beyond their remit. We were doing this protest, which was three of us. It was a tiny protest, three of us, with a placard, a megaphone, etc. And we were at the building. We went round the building, which is an office of Kudos Pharmaceuticals and a research base. And we were there doing our protest. And clearly there was no crime committed in Cambridge, which is where the protest was, at the time, because the police saw fit to send two vans, one car, and one 4x4, which was sent all the way from Huntingdon, from their unit which deals with protest, down for us three, who were peacefully protesting outside this company. Basically, they didn't see fit to arrest anyone at the time, and we decided that we'd had our protest and that we were going to move on, which we did. The police decided instead to wait for about a month until we were going to do a day of action against Huntingdon Life Sciences customers in Cambridge and other suppliers, etc. in Cambridge. They arrested me and another protester. They arrested the other protester first before the day of action and bailed her to come in on the day of action. And they arrested me on the day of action itself in an attempt to disrupt the day of action, clearly. The heinous crimes were accused of committing included posting a leaflet through the door of the company that we're protesting against. Clearly, there was no grounds for this arrest, and the CPS, Crown Prosecution Service, decided to drop the case a little while later, after we'd been on bail for quite a while, on the grounds of we were arrested under Section 5, and then it was up to Section 4A. If you don't know what these offences are, it's part of the Public Order Act, and basically the police use these offences as a catch-all. If they haven't got any evidence to arrest you, really, they'll use these pieces of legislation, especially Section 5. Really, what they say is that if you use threatening, abusive, insulting words or behaviour or disorderly conduct that is likely to cause harassment, alarm, or distress, then you're committing an offence. There's a very specific set of circumstances when you can be arrested for this, but that's not how the law is used by the police. Now, the problem is that the police continually do this. You'd be forgiven for thinking that this was a one-off isolated incident, but the fact is I've been arrested four times in the last 5 years of campaigning, and I have no criminal record whatsoever, no cautions, etc. Arrest is used as a way of disrupting protest. Now, you may think this is animal rights activists, and basically, you don't care how animal rights activists are treated. Fair enough. But all these laws start off with the people that there is a section of the public who won't mind what happens to them. And clearly, it will move on to other social justice movements. It will move on to everyone in this country. And the reason being, They can test these things out, and no one cares because it's done on animal rights activists. They test them out, and then they move them on to you. Say no to this and visit my YouTube page, youtube.com/AaronSpeaks. That's A-R-A-N and then Speaks. Thank you, and keep listening to the Badcast.
You have been listening to The Badcast. Check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk.
I was a small boy. I was a small boy from far away. Sam's a small boy. Sam's a small boy for virtually a day. Far away. The way. Sam. He was a wise man. Sam. He was quite a learned man. Sam. He was a wise man. Sam. He was quite a learned man. Far away. The way. Far away. The way. Ivan, like I believe we all have, virtually left me for dead. What actually happened to me over 2,000 years ago? 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago. Left me for dead. He was a wise man. Left me for dead. Left me for dead. He'd seen what had happened, and he said, Far away　The way. Far away, the way. Far away, the way. We come far away, the way. We could live, like I believe we could live. Over 2,000 years. Left me for dead. He was a wise man. Left me for dead. He was a wise man. Left me for dead. He was a wise man. Left me for dead.
I swear I will knock his block off.